The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at what happens when science interacts with politics. We've put together a fabulous panel of experts to explore the tension between evidence and rhetoric, and what happens when public policy ignores solid science. We'll talk to Cheryl Kirshenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, anthropologist blogger Greg Layden, and Sean Lawrence Otto, author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. But first, let's learn about an exciting new project to defend consensus science from the whims of political opinion. I'm here with Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education, a not-for-profit membership organization that provides information and resources to schools, parents, and concerned citizens working to keep evolution in public school science education. Welcome back to the show, Eugenie.
Thank you. So good to be here.
So the NCSE is broadening its focus a bit, is it?
Yes, you're going to have to change that tagline, or I should say we're going to have to change the tagline, because as of January 16th, we will be announcing that we will be helping parents and concerned citizens, etc., with problems involving the teaching of evolution and climate science. Because what we're finding is that just as teachers get hammered for teaching evolution, so also do they get pushback from the teaching of global warming and other climate science topics. And in our study of the issue, we've concluded that it's likely that we can be of some assistance in this problem. So we are adding that topic, and we're adding a climate scientist to the staff, and we're adding a climate scientist to our board of directors. And we're very excited about this new initiative.
We spoke a few months ago with Josh Rosenow, who also works at NCSE, about the parallels between evolution denialism and climate change denialism. And in fact, climate change education is kind of where evolution education was 30 years ago, correct?
I think that's exactly right. In the sense that teachers are only now beginning to face the kind of pushback from students or from parents or school boards and, alas, sometimes even state legislatures, that they were beginning to face 25 and 30 years ago for the teaching of evolution. Generally speaking, as evolution came back into the curriculum, so did anti-evolution. And as climate science is entering into the curriculum, so has also come the tendency for people to object to their children learning climate science. So we definitely, I'm glad that you and Josh have talked about this on an earlier show, and maybe this will encourage some of your listeners to go back and listen to that one. But yes, we do find many parallels between the structure of the argument, so to speak, that the anti-evolutionists and the anti-climate science people both use. And we think also the things that we've learned in the last 25 years of helping teachers and citizens with this problem of teaching evolution can be transferred, shall we say. How do you make a good and convincing argument to a school board? I mean, how do you help a parent understand the importance of teaching good science? And most important, perhaps, how do you recognize when the objection to a valid science like evolution or global warming really comes from an ideological point of view rather than from a scientific point of view. So our experience with evolution should, that kind of thing should be transferable.
So you will be using the same tactics then that you use to protect evolution education?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, how to make a good persuasive presentation to a school board is going to be the same whether you are dealing with evolution or whether you're dealing with climate science or any other controversial issue. We're looking forward to this with a certain amount of trepidation, but also with a lot of excitement. We are quite excited to be taking on new challenges.
Well, are you going to be keeping an eye on Canada, perchance?
Yeah, certainly we're going to keep our eye on Canada as well, both for evolution as well as climate change, because I think these two issues are controversial in Canada, but in somewhat different ways, as would be expected. It's a different legal system, different, you know, cultural differences and so forth. But teachers have problems teaching issues that are considered controversial, and these two are considered controversial in many places.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing where you guys go with this. But what can people do at this point to help NCSE?
As with evolution, we very much depend upon people in cities and states, people at the grassroots, who are willing to stand up for good science education. We are a small organization. There are 15,000 school districts. We can provide information and experience and advice and suggestions for how to deal with an issue, but we are so dependent, we all are so dependent upon the people willing to go to those school board meetings, call up those talk shows, write those letters to the editor. We encourage people to be local activists and to keep their ears open. If you hear a story from a neighbor or a friend or a child that a teacher is having problems or somebody's objecting to the teaching of either evolution or climate science, let us know and let that teacher know where that teacher can come for help. If you find that your school board or your state board of education or your state legislature is considering resolutions or bills that would compromise the teaching of science education, let us know. And let us know about you and your willingness to help. Because the old saying is that you get the government you deserve. Well, we get the education system we deserve. If we are willing to stand up for good science education, we'll get it. And we really appreciate it when citizens do that.
And there were actually two state bills in the U.S. introduced last year that would have suppressed climate change education.
Yes. And we're talking now within the first 2 weeks of 2012, and we've already had five anti-evolution bills submitted, and one of them is a twofer. One of them is evolution and climate science, and I'm sure it won't be the last.
Well, thanks very much, Eugenie, for being here. Everyone here at Skeptically Speaking absolutely loves NCSE, and we love what you guys do, so thank you very much.
Thank you. And we obviously are enormously grateful to the interest of the whole skeptics community in science education and critical thinking and things that we hold dear. So my opinion, it's a great partnership.
We've included a link to the National Center for Science Education on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Just may quickly add, after Monday, January 16th, there will be a whole new section of our website, which you'll be able to link to from the buttons at the top of the page. It'll be very obvious. It'll be brightly colored, the climate change button. And we hope that people will explore those resources and return to them, because we'll be adding to them over the months and years ahead.
Thanks, Eugenie.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, Greg Layton, and Sean Lawrence Otto after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we have a brilliant panel of experts to talk about science and politics. With me is Sean Lawrence Otto, CEO and co-founder of ScienceDebate.org, which it says here is the largest political initiative in the history of science. He blogs at Huffington Post and at neorenaissance.org, is an award-winning filmmaker and the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Sean.
Happy to be here.
We also have Cheryl Kirschenbaum, science writer and research associate at the Center for International Energy and Environmental Policy at the University of Texas at Austin, who was last on the show to talk about her book, The Science of Kissing. She was also the co-author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Good to have you back, Cheryl.
Glad to be back, Desiree. Thanks for having me on.
And rounding out the panel is show favorite anthropologist Greg Layden of Greg Layden's blog and the X blog on freethoughtblogs.com. And if you're not sure why we have an anthropologist on to talk politics, you have obviously never read Greg's blogs, and you should do that. Hello, Greg.
Good to see you, Desiree.
So my first question to all of you is a softball. Why should politicians be concerned with science and evidence in the first place?
You know, democracy was really based on the idea, Jefferson's idea, that whenever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government. And we live in a world today where science impacts every aspect of our lives and is really at the core of a lot of our biggest, most unsolved, most vexing public policy problems. So, of course, scientists in a democracy should care a lot about science and should care about voters being science literate so that they support politicians who actually are interested in solving problems.
Well, I would jump in and just add, you know, every major challenge that we face, all the ones we hear about in the media and what we don't hear about nearly enough, are all fundamentally science challenges, whether it's new technologies, creating jobs, national security, energy, all of it is science. And so if science isn't informing policy, then a special interest group or a particular agenda is, and that's simply unacceptable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In fact, I just saw a talk today by Sean, and he showed a slide that listed, it was a long list of several, a couple dozen of the current problems we're facing as a nation in economics and environment and so on that were all related to science. And the bottom line is science is like magic. If you want to figure out the formula for figuring out the best solution to something, it will tell you what the best solution we know of right now is, subject to revision. And all the other solutions are things people made up or things that people have that serve their own interests but don't really serve the policy at hand.
Well, let's talk about some of those policy decisions, specifically the ones that we've seen recently that maybe aren't based on science and evidence. Are there any particularly sore points for you?
Well, there's a lot of sore points. Look at the failure of the climate bill about 18 months ago as one of them. That was a disappointment to even people like George W. Bush's former chief economic policy advisor, Doug Holtz-Eakin. It was really a testament to the short-circuiting of the democratic process.
And how about the fact that we don't even hear the word climate used lately by the current administration, which is supposed to be a more pro-science administration? It's too politically charged, I guess, and it's just not something that they'll even address in that language. Of course, we do hear about energy.
And also, it's the 15th of January, and we've already had something like four or five separate bills, although they're distributed among two states, that will outlaw the teaching of only science in biology classrooms. The laws would require the teaching of creationism along with evolutionary sciences in high school biologists and public schools.
Let's just make sure people understand that now, although you're all from the United States, this is not just a right. This is not just a U.S. problem. We do see it in Canada as well. How familiar are you guys with Canadian politics in this way?
In the blogosphere, there are a lot of bloggers who are talking about the same issues and who are doing that from Canada. And I know Larry Moran, for example, blogs about this stuff. And basically, I think that the United States is kind of the hotbed of denialism in general in the Western world. And the Canadians and the British and other groups of people are only a little bit behind us in some areas. So I think that there's some similar issues going on there.
Well, we do completely blame you for this, which is...
Yeah, it is our fault, but, completely our fault.
Just to let people know, though, that in Canada, there was opposition to the regulation of natural health products. The recent destruction of the long-form census was a big one. Hysteria over GMO research. We do have a lot of that. And opposition to harm reduction drug policy, that was fairly recent as well. So we do have our own issues. And of course, the ongoing climate science issues.
Across the ocean, it's really interesting to look at science literacy because the types of anti-science forces are very different. And so whereas here we're used to hearing a lot of climate denial in the U.S., a lot of aggression toward the teaching of evolution in our schools, in Europe it's a lot more frustration over genetically modified foods and a lack of understanding how transgenic agriculture works and different problems, but all the same sort of pseudoscience trumping what the real research is about.
I should say, too, that it's not just limited to the political right in the United States. For instance, a few months ago, the San Francisco City Council, or I should say the Board of Supervisors is what they're called there, all of them Democrats, voted 10-1 to require cell phone shops in San Francisco to post a warning that cell phones can cause brain cancer, even though there is no evidence of this whatsoever. And in fact, Einstein won his Nobel Prize for a 1905 paper that pretty much showed just the opposite.
We do have a question from the audience, and he is a Canadian. This is from Donald.
How can the minister responsible for allocating research funds be a creationist? It makes us look silly.
And he's right, but I'm wondering if that isn't a sign of how little value science has in the eyes of the Canadian government, and if that's sort of what it would mean in any country.
Yeah, I would say, you know, science across the board is treated as a special interest group rather than something central to any of these issues. And so that right there is the problem. You know, it shouldn't decide every policy by any means, but it should certainly be given a more significant role in the policymaking process than some of the others.
Yeah, this gets right back to the root of how democracy was formed and is supposed to work. It was based essentially on the ideas of empiricism. And John Locke noticed how arguments between different sects of religion could go on forever, each claiming to be the one true religion, and that we had to define a way to decide who was right when they made a claim. And he wrote a paper, an essay concerning human understanding, where he really laid out how it is that something is knowledge versus belief or opinion. And he was one of the most important influences on Thomas Jefferson when he first sat down to draft the Declaration of Independence, and then in his further thinking about how we base public policy not on belief or opinion, but on knowledge. So it really is central, but we've gotten away from that in the last 40 or 50 years.
And so you bring up history. So it hasn't always been like this, has it? Has politics always referred to ideology over science and evidence?
It's gone in and out. For instance, in the United States, about 100 years ago, the Republican Party was the party of science, and it was the Democratic Party that was anti-science. Greg, help me out here. Now I'm blanking on the name.
Are you looking for Clarence Darrow?
No, I'm not. I'm looking for William Jennings Bryan.
Right.
Who ran as a Democrat three times on the anti-evolution ticket, driving most scientists to become Republicans. Really, though, our current problems in the United States anyway came about after Sputnik and after the 1950s, and scientists really began to withdraw from the public dialogue at that point and focus on research, as they should, because science really drives our economic development in both countries. But with their absence from the dialogue, other forces moved in. Evangelical religion organized and took up a greater share of the public dialogue with all kinds of television shows that came on in the 60s and 70s with televangelists. And at the same time, science itself started kind of taking a black eye in the public's perception over environmental problems that started coming to the fore from previous science. So the public became skeptical about science, and that has only continued.
Well, I think there was a time when science was part of progress. Science and progress kind of went together, and making these new machines and fueling them with minerals, coal, or mining, and turning ore into products and so on. Was, you know, science was the future. And yeah, as Sean points out, the environmental outcome of that became more and more serious over time, and that became an inconvenience. And I think within science, people are perfectly happy to say, oh, okay, we're doing this thing that's actually harmful, so let's change the way we do it. And those very self-same interests that were using science and progress as part of their mantra before had to continue using science as their way of getting things done, but in public, the mantra had to change, and the culture had to change from science leading us to science being an inconvenient truth, and other things being more important, like making sure that taxes were low and making sure that we were ideologically in a certain box. And science became – it was easy to marginalize science. Those very self-centered people that are making sure that science is marginalized today from the point of view of industry are absolutely 100% using science and technology every day to get richer. And it's not that they're against science at all. They're completely dependent upon science, and they're all for science as long as they're the ones buying and selling it and controlling it.
You know, I was just in a conversation in Washington, D.C. about this, and somebody made the point, which I think is very true, that when science began to diverge from business interests with the rise of the fields of environmental science, and we became aware of some of the effects of industrial practices, that is when the split really began to grow. And this gets to the basics of science's political nature. Going back to the days of Galileo, who challenged then the seat of world political and economic power, the Catholic Church, by making a simple observation through a telescope. Today, climate scientists are doing the same thing, challenging the vested interests of the Western energy industry. So it's nothing new, but I think that that's really when it began to develop in the latter part of the 20th century.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking about science and politics with anthropologist Greg Layden, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, and Sean Lawrence Otto, the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. Now, just to be clear, both parties have less than ideal responses to science occasionally, right? It's not just right-wing parties.
One of the obvious examples is the anti-vaccination movement. And that tends to be a stance taken by liberal, affluent, well-educated parents who are doing their own research online through Google and finding an outdated Wakefield study that has since been retracted and investigated for fraudulent research. But finding that online, it sounds a lot like science, using it as evidence to not vaccinate their kids. And then their kids are getting all sorts of things like whooping cough that should be all but not going around the U.S. And then in turn, the kids who are really paying the price are usually the less affluent children of people who, you know, don't have access to those vaccines. And so it's a real problem. And wireless internet is another example of groups that don't want it in their town because they're worried that it'll zap their children or something.
Yeah, that's the same kind of thinking as the cell phone causes brain cancer scare. And a lot of it, I've noticed on the political left, tends to be about hidden dangers. And I think that some of this really comes out of the environmental movement and the whole foods movement. And that's why the left, you'll see more anti-GMO crop thinking as well as these other ideas about health. They go along with the alternative medicine movement and the alternative health movement. On the political right, it's more challenges to business interests, particularly on the climate change issue or on environmental issues, and also challenges to organized religion. That's why we see this effort that, for instance, Greg was talking about to push creationism in science class.
It's also worth noting that the anti-vaccine and some other health-related groups, as well as probably the microwave people and so on, and GMOs, very much so, and people who are worried about GMOs, a lot of that is also fear and loathing of large corporations. And it's probably not poorly placed, fear and loathing either. I mean, GMOs may have zero medical or health-related problems, and they may be the way to feed the future. But they are largely produced by large corporations that I don't think anyone should necessarily trust just because they're nice guys, that are staffed, and the people who work for those corporations, for the most part, are people who are just like anyone else. They're sincerely interested in doing a good job, and they may have very strong ideological reasons for trying to save the world with their science. So it's a complicated mixture of people in corporate boardrooms that we really want to keep an eye on, and science that is very important and that has to be done carefully but must be done. And the average person doesn't have an opinion that I've hardly ever met anyone on either side of that issue who's ever had an opinion that really incorporated all of those different issues, whether it's large pharmaceutical companies or GMO manufacturing companies, all those elements, large corporations, sincerely interested scientists, important medical or scientific research, and applications that are absolutely demanding these technologies are all mixed together in one complex interconnected whole, if you will, and very few people actually have opinions on these things that capture that level of complexity.
If indeed both parties are responsible for anti-science policies occasionally, why do we keep referring to the Republicans as being sort of the anti-science party?
Because they're worse.
Yeah, because they're notoriously worse, absolutely.
So well, it is a question of scale then.
Well, you find with a lot of Republican candidates, they almost will brag about not being focused on science. I mean, it becomes sort of a medal of honor, I think, to come out with some very anti-science positions on really key issues like climate, for example. And so I think because of that, we're more apt to blame them when it comes down to why bad policy gets enacted. But it's certainly not as black and white as it appears. And that's one thing that I think we don't always take into account. I mean, anytime it's an election year, no one's going to risk saying anything that might disturb their base. And in uncertain times where all of a sudden there's the Tea Party influencing who does what in which party, it's a really, really difficult political climate for anyone to push new ideas through or better science policy through. And that's, I think, the pushback we're seeing right now.
I think one of the reasons that scientists feel they're worse is because there's a greater propensity, and this really began, it really reached a crescendo during the Bush administration, to put ideology ahead of science. And this was anything from pulling back or holding back reports to making false links between abortion and breast cancer on the CDC website, to lying about results of climate research, or saying that any reference to the Big Bang had to be treated with the word theory in front of it, because we wouldn't want to deny the validity of other creation stories. So they generally, because of the organized religion component of it, and because of the big business component on the climate side, they have been much more aggressive about trying to quash science that they find inconvenient to their agenda.
Within the United States, the two parties are very different in a way that has to be kind of underscored. You may have heard in Canada and other places about the famous Coleman-Franken recount. We had a senatorial race here, and Al Franken, as he says, won that Senate race in the most efficient way possible. He didn't spend a dime more than necessary to win by 218 votes. I was involved in that recount, and there were times when I was standing around in a room with a bunch of Republicans talking or a bunch of Democrats talking, and the kinds of conversation were utterly different. And among four or five or six Democrats, it was very common to have everybody have very distinctly different views on really important issues. There were anti-abortion and pro-choice people having a conversation, and people have really different views on the economy and really different views on other things. But people were very willing to actually all call themselves members of the same party and all ultimately vote for the same person. That was the year Obama won. And you usually, even if someone might be against GMOs, they're very worried about microwave transmissions from their cell phones, but they'll also say, I'm going to trust the science on climate change. I don't understand it. I'm going to trust the scientists. Or of course we should teach good science in our schools and not teach creationism. You never hear from Republicans a mixture of views where two Republicans have two different sets of views. That doesn't happen. They all have the same view, because that's what being a Republican means. It doesn't mean having mostly right-wing views. And what I'm saying is going to make some people mad, but those people are ex-Republicans. Okay, they're not current Republicans. People have left the party because they have views that differ from other individuals. And right now, this has become made very easy with Obama in office, because all you have to do is take whatever view isn't his. So all Republicans know what view they should have. And that almost by default makes Obama pro-science, because Republicans tend to be anti-science. But my point is, it's not a matter of having suspicions of something or having believing in some woo or some alternative medicine, but having that mixed with, yes, I like biology. It's not a matter of having different opinions that are misinformed. It's a matter of having a lockstep set of views that aren't informed by this religious fundamentalism, that are determined by a handful of gurus like Rush Limbaugh, mostly entertainers, people on Fox News, who say what the rhetoric should be that by which these views are presented. So there's anti-science in both parties, but the nature of it is really, really fundamentally different.
Yeah. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with a panel of experts to talk about science and politics. My guests are Cheryl Kirshenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America; Sean Lawrence Otto, the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America; and Greg Layden, anthropologist, blogger, and the guy responsible for our semi-regular segment, Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. So what happens when the findings of science run contrary to a party's interests or ideology or their current policy? What kind of response do we usually see?
It really depends on the issue, I think, but either something's not covered or it's there was a publication in Nature Geoscience about how climate change might influence putting off the next ice age. And what I saw on the right-wing conservative sort of special interest websites was, look, climate change turns out to be great after all. But then when you actually talk to the science folks involved, they say, actually, no, if sea ice is going to melt at this really quick rate, we're going to have sea level rise very quickly. And that puts a lot of folks in developing countries who don't have the means to adapt quickly enough in danger. And so you hear two different stories about the same thing when only one of them is based in science and the other is kind of massaged into the agenda of that particular group.
So then to what degree is the actual suppression of information an issue?
Well, it was a big issue during the Bush administration, and that's really what motivated so many people to support Science Debate 2008 back then. It's not really been as much of an issue in the Obama administration, although there are some who might argue that he skated around that a little bit. But with the attempts to put in scientific integrity policies and some level of whistleblower protection in the federal government, those have been very, very, very slow to be implemented. But I think that scientists are making progress in that way.
That also underscores a party difference as well, because under Bush, apparently information was repressed. Scientists that were not towing the line were nudged out. Regulations that were based upon scientific information were ignored or not implemented or slowed down. Under Obama, with Republicans still around, because you don't just get rid of them, what we've seen is Republican senators using the investigatory powers of various offices in Washington to do the same kind of thing, but from their bench instead of from the executive office, doing it from the units. Every single government of a unit of government has some kind of a miniature internal investigative body, and those are being deployed to. Because senators can simply make these things happen. They can send a letter and you have to go investigate. For example, there's something recent. I think Sean may know the details better than I do on this, but the scientists who had reported polar bears dying and being floating around because there was not enough ice in the Arctic, his work has been seriously investigated and looked into and very suspiciously, like it was all made up or all done wrong. And I think that all originated with Republicans in the Senate demanding that that be done. And the work wasn't bad. And it just was a way of making it hard to be a scientist doing your job, because if you don't keep your head down, this will happen to you.
This may be a stupid question, but how often do politicians actually change their mind when confronted with science?
Well, look at Newt Gingrich. I mean, someone who was talking about climate change not too long ago is not so proud of the fact that he did that and sat next to Nancy Pelosi. And so often I think it's challenging, because I think you really have to make the distinction that it varies by politician. And it can vary significantly. But I think it also has to do with convenience on any issue, especially during election season when times are much more sensitive. People are willing to say and do different things than they might say or do when they feel a little more secure in their position.
We have a question via email from Harvey.
Do you think that the fact that such a large population of the people in Congress are trained as attorneys has an effect on how they approach evidence?
Absolutely, I do. Right now we have 9 people with professional scientific background in Congress of the 535 members, and we have 222 lawyers. So that gives you kind of some sense of how much of Congress approaches the idea of argument and decision making. Most of those lawyers, I would venture to guess, dodged science classes in college, and probably their last science class was a required chemistry class in high school. They generally will approach questions of fact as if they were in a trial. And opposing counsel will do their discovery and their research, and they will cherry pick the arguments that best represent their client's point of view or the argument that they want to make. And they'll assume that their opponents will do the same, and then either a judge or, in the case of Congress, the voting majority will make the decision about who's right. But the problem is that when you do that, if you don't weigh knowledge, which is based on data, with a heavier weighting than you do just opinion, you don't wind up with good public policy. And right now, that's what's happening. You know, we've had the rise over the last 40 or 50 years in our university systems of something called postmodernism that informed most of our education programs. And most of our journalism programs. I've seen newspapers that their code of conduct for their reporters come right out and say there is no such thing as objective truth. And if you believe that, then you feel that there is no truth ultimately that it's your job to get to. And when we have opinion elevated to the same level as knowledge, the result is paralysis. And that's what we're seeing right now in our public policy discussion.
But it's not just politicians themselves that can be a problem. It's the public. It's us.
That's right.
They care about public opinion because it can cost them votes. And the public opinion of science is frequently questionable, correct?
Absolutely. That's why Cheryl was part of this with me. We started sciencedebate.org in an attempt to bring scientists and politicians together with the media and the public to fill that ever-widening gap between those four people, to work at the nexus of the problem. Because really, politicians have to respond to their constituents. I once talked to a member of Congress about this particular question, and I said, what constitutes a groundswell of support on an issue? And he said, 12 calls. If I get 12 calls that are not packaged calls on something, I'll pay attention to it. So people can really have an influence on this if they care about it.
If we could just backtrack 1 minute, though, when we were talking about members and them being attorneys and how they make their stance on issues, I think it's really important to also pay attention to where they're getting their information, because there are a lot of very, very well-informed pseudoscientific groups coming to lobby Congress. There's usually a large hesitancy among the scientific community to get very involved. Of course, we have groups like the Union of Concerned Scientists and others, but for the most part, scientists haven't been trained to really tell these stories, to get the message across clearly and succinctly, and do so in a manner that when it goes to a Congress member's staff, trickles back up to that member and influences voting. Whereas a lot of pseudoscientific groups will serve food, tell jokes, be very articulate, have a PhD after their name too, and make a much better case.
Yeah, Cheryl's point is really well taken, especially when you consider that since 1994, Congress closed its science advisory body, the Office of Technology Assessment. That was Congress's independent source of scientific advice. And without that, most members of Congress, who again are not trained in basing arguments on science, and they don't necessarily understand how the scientific process works and why it's better, they get their scientific information generally from lobbyists or the internet, both of which are not very reliable sources.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more science and politics after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we take a look at some of the most fascinating things we've learned about the brain. We'll revisit some of our favorite episodes on the brain and its fascinating functions, from interpreting music to justifying cruel behavior and its role in gender identity. And we're joined by Ingrid Wickelgren, editor at Scientific American Mind, for a new segment on how our brains are wired to believe weird things. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today's episode deals with science and politics, and we have a fantastic panel here to help us wade through the muck. My guests are Sean Lawrence Otto, the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. We have anthropologist and super blogger Greg Layden. And we have Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America. So let's get to a few audience questions so I don't receive angry emails. This one's from Mike.
I think that a large part of the problem is that people aren't as interested in science as they are in popular media. More Americans will watch the auditions for American Idol than they will watch a Nova program, even if Neil deGrasse Tyson hosts Nova Now, or the updated version of Cosmos. Is there a way to increase the popularity of science without compromising accuracy?
First of all those people watching American Idol, if for every 10 people, there's actually one person with 10 cell phones. It's a little bit exaggerated, I think, the popularity of those shows. Science is very much in the popular media. There are several hours of science programming in the way of fiction every week. Dinosaurs on islands in the past and CSI is everywhere. And to me, you know, people, if they get their science from TV and it makes them unqualified to actually be a forensic investigator, to actually be a paleontologist, I don't care because that's not what they are anyway. I'm not too worried about compromising the science. I'd rather let it be culturally more involved and sexier or more marketable, whatever you want, however you want to put it. Because actual scientists know what to do. When scientists are denigrated in the media or they're put down or they're looked at as suspicious, that would be really bad. And I think actually science is pretty positive in the media. And I think that when I talk to scientists, as when the CSI shows are starting to come out, and you know, my field of study overlaps with forensics, and a lot of my colleagues, you know, didn't like this, and it's bad that they showed that it only takes 2 minutes to run a DNA sample, and it's bad that this and that happened. And I think that scientists didn't come up to the plate. They haven't embraced the popular presentation and representation of science as they should have, and capitalized on it, because it really is out there for several hours every week. There's science on regular TV, and it's even got its own networks. And yeah, it's poorly done, but you know, I don't really agree that it's not, that people aren't interested. I think people really like it.
And I'd like to add, the Big Bang Theory is informed by science. And I think they do a pretty good job of getting things. I mean, it's not, I know a lot of people who criticize the characters. I personally think it's funny. But they work hard at getting the equations you see in the background right, and the books that should be on those people's shelves. I think there is more attention to it. But as far as media, if you want to wade into journalism, I mean, we have seen a sharp decline in science coverage in newspapers. But at the same time, we've seen a rise in the number of scientists engaging through blogs, which has its positives and its negatives, depending on if you're talking about misinformation or real people in the academic community getting engaged. But I think, you know, we're seeing a media shift, and we don't quite know where it's going to go at this point.
Well, on the subject of blogs, we have a question from the chat from Cy Curious.
I keep hearing that the internet allows for more of an echo chamber where people can preferentially watch or intake their own views. Is there evidence to support this in anti-science views currently?
I don't know about a study or specific evidence for that, but I can tell you that if you take any controversial issue, especially in medicine, and it's the stuff Cy Curious blogs about, you know, would be an example of this, and just look it up on the internet, you'll find that a very large percentage of the material on the internet about that is the stuff that we would say is not scientific, especially with medical issues. If the average person just shows up, sits down at their computer and tries to find out, it's the first time that their kid child has to be vaccinated, they have a new baby, and they just look up vaccination, they're going to learn from the internet that they should not let anyone anywhere near their child with a vaccine.
Right.
That's what they're absolutely going to learn. If they would only look at the Mayo Clinic website, I mean, everyone's heard of the Mayo Clinic, you'd think you might look there for information on this kind of thing. But by the time you get to those places, you've been told that they're in a conspiracy to trick you into vaccinating your child. So I think that in terms of echo chamber, there is a huge one, and it's a very much of an anti-science echo chamber. And it's not the science bloggers, it's other people, but that's a problem. That's a huge problem we've had. And we've talked about, you know, we're all going to this conference next weekend. At this conference, the last few years, this has been brought up again and again, a conference among bloggers. How do you certify or somehow just make it so that people can find out which websites are for real, which ones aren't, without being the repressive big brother that is controlling information? And no one has come up with any really good way of doing that.
And just to interject, brief plug for Science Online 2012. All four of us will be there. If you are not going, I feel bad for you. And you should really get in line earlier next year.
I think one of the things that Greg brings up is what I like to call intellectual or online hygiene. And this is the kind of thing that science teachers used to teach kids in science class, and some still do, and that's how to be skeptical and how to critically think about claims that you hear from advertisers or from, in this case, anyone on the internet. And it's very easy to forget what we learned in seventh grade science class about that, but it's become even more important, especially when we're just doing internet searches that are based on keywords and that are not providing any kind of hygiene about the veracity of representations that are made. And there's arguments to be said, well, you shouldn't, to be made saying, well, you shouldn't do that, that everybody has a right to voice their opinion. That's true, but we do need some kind of filtering mechanism to figure out when something is true and when it's not. Now, there are some organizations out there like TruthSeal.com, which I'm involved with as an advisor, that are kind of trying to take an innovative approach to give a good housekeeping seal of approval. What TruthSeal does, is they put up a bounty. And if anybody makes a claim and somebody can disprove it, they win the bounty. And I think that we'll see more and more of that developing over the next 5 or 10 years, because how it's becoming a real challenge to our decision making.
We have a question from Dario Ringach.
A recent Nature poll indicates that 92% of scientists believe that, quote, animal research is essential to the advances of biomedical science, end quote. This indicates a very strong scientific consensus on this issue, compared to 87% of scientists that believe in evolution. On the other hand, public support for animal research stands merely at 52%. What would happen to our ability to seek out new cures and therapies to advance human health? Should our representatives follow public opinion instead of scientific consensus?
Well, they have followed public opinion. A couple years ago, Congress ordered the National Academies of Sciences to study this issue with respect specifically to chimpanzees, because they're a key organism as far as this goes. And there's been a study that was just released, and they've come out with some findings, and there'll be changes in what's been done. First of all, it's not true that 87% of scientists, that's kind of inaccurate to say that they believe in evolution. It's actually way more than that. Polls like that usually include people who are like engineers, and they're not really scientists. Right. It's really like 100%, okay? And the thing is that if you take people, sit them down, and say, okay, we're going to talk about animal research. What do you think? And you talk about the details. It isn't really 52%, 95%. It's really more like most people agree on a certain things, and then they begin to disagree as you get into certain details. And it's much closer than that looks. If you actually ask people, what about this kind of research and this kind of research and this kind of research, what people want is much closer to what our policies in the United States actually are. There are areas in the fringe that are not settled. And I think that people looking at great apes are more differentiated. Some people think you should use them for research. Some people think they should be exactly like humans and not use at all. And then there's research that gets farmed out. There is probably private corporate research that gets done in other countries because it's cheaper to do it with the animals there. I don't think that's extensive, but it sort of happens. But it isn't really true that the general public and scientists are at odds on the issue of animal research to that degree.
Well, I think the important part of that question is, what if politicians continue to follow public opinion instead of actual science? What are the repercussions there?
Well, I mean, I think to a large extent, they have to continue to follow some public opinion, because otherwise they'll lose their office and someone else will take it. I mean, this is a discussion I had very recently with a colleague after the Plan B decision, which kind of riveted the nation, where Plan B wasn't allowed to be made over-the-counter available to young women, even though the science suggested that women of those ages, you know, were aware enough to make those decisions, even though, you know, if anyone knows the context, they know what I'm talking about. But the point is, you know, It's a very tricky situation, because science needs to take a leading role, but science certainly isn't the only factor. And I don't think we're ever going to be in a situation where we see science being the absolute deciding force for policy, because it doesn't always incorporate the people who understand economics or other social factors just about what's practical and possible and what's going to be a policy that works.
What we need is for people to get really mad at politicians who stand up and gloat over the fact that they are anti-science. That is just wrong, and those people should be voted out of. The public should be a bit mad at them. And as far as the difference between the public and science goes, also, I think this matches with what Cheryl was just saying, is that elected officials are not supposed to just do what the public opinions polls say. They're supposed to lead, at least to some extent. And that is a difficult thing to do, but that's why they get paid all that money, and there's only a few of them that we elect to do it, because it's hard to do.
Okay, now, I had an article sent to me by a ridiculous number of people, but listener Gilbert forwarded it to us first, so I will mention your name. And it was about the Stop Online Piracy Act and how it will kill scientific debate. Now, Greg, you and I spoke about this, so could you explain what that's all about?
Basically, the Stop Online Piracy Act, it helps to solve a problem where copyrighted material in the United States, which is being pirated and streamed online or put out there somehow in other countries, that can be controlled somewhat. So, for example, okay, this is an international conversation. Let's say that Skeptically Speaking website decided to post Sean's book without getting permission on your website. With SOPA, because you're in Canada, Sean could very easily go to the Justice Department and get court orders that would require the bits and pieces underneath the internet that allow you to hook to different websites to turn you off, disconnect you from the internet so that you could be found but not easily. PayPal or Amazon or MasterCard or Visa would no longer work with you, and any other kind of institutional or financial group would not legally be able to interact with you. It'd be almost like if, you know, Macy's was sitting there in a big shopping mall and a little boutique down the way started competing with them. Macy's could send their guys over there and just board it up. So you can't do it anymore. But legally, okay? And the problem with that is, it also makes it...
Wait a minute. Am I Macy's or the boutique?
You're, in this case, Macy's. But the thing is, it makes it so easy to do that, let's just say that Sean wanted to shut you down. He could take his book and pretend that he's someone else and post it on your website as comments. It's sort of like going to a restaurant and letting a bunch of cockroaches loose and then calling the health department to shut it down. it would be easy for U.S. corporations or individuals or interests to shut down foreign websites by faking a copyright infringement.
And what does that have to do with science?
First of all, an intermediate step is U.S. passes this law, every other country passes a similar law, so the entire world now works this way, or at least several countries. So now you've got an English law, a British law that mirrors the American law. So a bunch of global warming denialists in England closed down the American Association of Advancement of Science's website because they publish Science Magazine. They make it look like Science Magazine is stealing copyrighted materials. And a bunch of American global warming denialists shut down Nature in England, and so on. It just makes it very easy. I mean, obviously, the way this would actually work is large corporations put their resources, as they do now, into doing various marketing things and so on, and legal things. You know, I know a guy who invented a way of making a piece of wood into something you would light on fire in your fireplace to get your wood burning. And he called it something that used the word light in it because you light it on fire. And a major corporation that makes a beverage simply showed up with their lawyers and said, you can't call it that. We have a product that has the word light in it. They couldn't possibly have won that in court, but he couldn't possibly have defended himself, okay? So trademark and copyright already works that way. It's already true that the really big guys get to push around little guys. This just makes instruments for them to do it in a really major way internationally in ways that would allow, for example, the energy industry to shut down climate research.
Should this be as intensely worrying to me as it seems?
It's not a science issue that I personally deal with, but I think that it would be a real paradigm change. I mean, no one would even know how to make sense of it if it came to pass. And so, yeah, that's very troubling because who knows what would happen.
It's one of those well-intentioned things that we'll probably eventually see some aspect of it out there, but it needs a lot more fine-tuning.
Right now, you would have to go to the Justice Department to get what you wanted as a big corporation. And then you have to ask yourself, what Justice Department is in operation when that happens, if the law goes as it is now? Is it the one like the Bush Justice Department or one like the Obama Justice Department? I agree. I think it attempts to solve a problem that's real, and it does it in a ham-handed way that won't work. But yeah, that is also the true of every single piracy-stopping piece of legislation that's ever been passed. All they ever do is annoy the end user and make the pirates chuckle for a moment and then, you know, board the next ship with their scabbards and stuff and take over. This has unintended large side effects that, yeah, it makes it possible for private corporations or individuals to shut down huge portions of the internet for financial gain. And there's nothing like that now. That's why it is a paradigm shift.
So really, this is an example of legislation that wasn't even necessarily focused at science, still hurting science.
Yes.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with anthropologist Greg Layden, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, and Sean Lawrence Otto, the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. And today's topic is science and politics. I think we've established that there are some problems. Someone should be doing something about that, correct?
Well, I think a lot of people are doing something. It's just there's not a cure-all. So a lot of us have to keep working really hard to make sure that science has its place in politics.
Well, there's really two groups that I'm thinking of specifically. There's scientists and then there's science advocates. What responsibility do scientists have for trying to correct politicians when they do base their policy decisions on anti-science?
It depends on whether or not they are federal employees or not. There is something called the Hatch Act that prohibits certain federally paid scientists from entering the political fray. So it becomes complicated. But it is part of your responsibility as a citizen to speak out and to take anti-science thinking on and to expose it and to talk to your friends and neighbors about it, to run for school board, to go down to your local church and give a presentation on how it is that scientists arrive at their thinking, and just get involved in the community, which is something that scientists have really not done as much as they could over the last 40 or 50 years.
There's a lot of scientists and a lot of people who are in industries that are related to science. And, you know, there is a thing called the Union of Concerned Scientists, and the key word there is union. I think that if you looked at it from a union perspective, if scientists as a whole were better organized into two or three really major groups beyond what exists now, because what exists now obviously is not enough, they could have a bigger place at the table, and individuals, scientists could have some degree of involvement, a greater degree or lesser degree, depending on where their career is. You know, it's a little hard for me to have this conversation because I just heard this talk by Sean, and we agree on most of these things. So I'm going to quote him again. Within academia, it actually has been for a long time, and it's still largely true, a very bad thing to engage in public policy or public issues or public conversations. It's not what the university pays you to do. And if you do those things, it reduces your chance of promotion and tenure. Mm-hmm. And every single person almost in those academic areas agrees that that's wrong. Yet for some reason, that's still the policy. And just because everyone knows it's wrong doesn't somehow affect people doing it. But that has to change. And I think if there's a larger scale organization of things, that would help. I mean, all these universities full of scientists, all these private institutions full of scientists, they're a lot of people. And they can have more power than they have now. They just have to go out there and literally take it.
Yeah, I would say one other thing that people can do is get involved, sign the petition at sciencedebate.org to get the candidates for president, in this case, to debate science issues. But also, this can grow. You know, members running for parliament, members running for Congress, they can also participate in science debates. Really, science needs to be a part of the discussion, a bigger part. For democracy to work successfully, we need a plurality of voices. And to arrive at balanced public policy.
And I think that we need to demonstrate that policy can be a viable career trajectory for young scientists, that it's not, I hate the word non-traditional position. It should be a very well-rewarded, well-respected way to engage and contribute in the policy realm as a scientist. And so I'm hoping we're going to keep seeing more of that. I know that the AAAS fellowships and NOAA fellowships and a lot of these opportunities for young scientists currently are appealing, but many young people are dissuaded because it takes time away from publishing. And so in terms of the academic trajectory, it does not help you get a tenure track position. But I'd love to see that sort of evolve and change as it needs to.
I'm going to end the interview with the hard question. It's from Steve.
Aren't a lot of policy decisions inherently values-based instead of evidence-based? For example, economics and foreign policy. How can we look at these kind of policy decisions from a scientific perspective?
I would say that that's actually kind of an easy question because you draw on evidence in making the decision. But I don't think any one of the three of us is saying that we need to use science for everything. If you look at climate change, for instance, there's a range. You can deny that the climate is changing, or then you can say, okay, well, the climate's changing, but people aren't causing it. Or you can say, well, climate's changing, and maybe people are causing some part of it, but the climate's always changed. Or else you can say, all right, well, people are causing climate change, but we can't necessarily afford to do anything about it. And at that point, you cross out of anti-science, and then you're in a legitimate value-driven discussion about what should we do about the science. And I don't think that any of us would take issue that discussion is a legitimate discussion for politicians to be having.
I can extend that one step farther as well. Within the anti-global warming conversation, people are saying, some people are now saying, okay, it's real, it's human caused, and it will have consequences. And yes, if our carbon goes up to dinosaur age levels, all of the world's major cities that are near coastal areas will be flooded, but cities are obsolete. They have to be rethought. So where the science comes in here is not about values and not about policy, but about the simple fact that if you were to raise sea level a certain amount, you would have to move all the cities. And that's just going to have to happen. And that's the kind of thing that you can't walk away from. You can't say, yeah, but I'm a Republican, therefore that doesn't matter. It just doesn't work. Science brings to the table alternatives and options that have specific consequences. Sometimes we know more about them, sometimes we know less about them, that have to be addressed. And what has to happen is the policy debate simply has to realistically incorporate those things. And that's, again, yeah, I agree, it's kind of an easy question because it's not actually about values versus about evidence base. It's about bringing the realities that science does address into the conversation fully and not putting them aside for reasons of convenience.
I agree with everything that Greg and Sean just said. I think a lot of it is about us making a better case, demonstrating the connections between science and all these other things we consider when we're making good policy. And so I hope that becomes a bigger part of the conversation in the coming years. And I will continue to hope that until it does.
And we are completely out of time. Cheryl, Sean, Greg, thank you very, very much for being here. That was great.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've linked to everyone's blogs and books and such on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and to Google+, so that you can keep up with the show news, and also to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program or listen to past episodes or perhaps write a glowing review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.